The following presentation was recorded at the Buddhist Society of Victoria, Malvern East, Australia. Please visit our website at bsv.net.au.
For those that are just tuning into the talk, this is Ajahn Nasarana from the Buddha Loka Buddha Centre here at the Buddhist Society of Victoria. And we are streaming live from the centre here in Melbourne, not from the monastery. So today I'd like to, I was going to talk about impermanence again, because one can talk about impermanence a great deal, as Adrian was saying about Ajahn COVID, because it's teaching us a lot about uncertainty, which is another translation or another experience, how we experience impermanence. Because impermanence brings up that sense of uncertainty, what to rely on, what to depend on, because things are changing. And this has always been the real situation. However, it's become much more apparent with Ajahn COVID, with COVID-19. But I'm not going to talk about that. And my last talk was about harmony. But considering the events of the world that we see, and you know, even here in Australia, I've seen a lot of division and disharmony in the world. And of course, we had last week the storming of the Capitol in the US, which is significant for the whole world because it impacts on the whole world, of course. And of course, we have here in Australia, there's always dissension and division. You see quite a lot of it. It's part of nature. It is part of nature. It's a natural thing to happen. But it's an important thing to deal with wisely. And this is what the talk will be about, because it affects all of us, whether it's in at the family level, in the community level that we live in, the community that we live in, you know, the district we live in, whether it's the Buddhist society, where we work, or we're at school. There can be all these divisions and disharmony. And so it's important how we deal with that phenomena, which is a natural phenomena. And as I was saying, for the new year, you know, people always say, have a good, happy new year. And in order to make it a good new year or a happy new year, we really need to make the mind good. This is how we can make the year good. Because if our mind is good, if our understanding, our wisdom is good, and our practice is good, then it will be a good year, no matter what happens, you know. And this is the benefit of, you know, the teachings of the Buddha. It prepares us for whatever comes so that we can deal with it in the best possible way. So this is what I will focus on today. And when I was thinking about this subject, you know, this came to mind, the Dalai Lama, a quote from the Dalai Lama came to mind. So, of course, I had to Google it to find the exact wording, but of course the Dalai Lama has said many things on this subject, so you've got a whole choice really. But the Dalai Lama said, my religion is very simple. My religion is kindness. And it's a lovely saying, isn't it? I really find that quite powerful. And it's like saying that the Buddha's teaching, or any teaching, any spiritual teaching, its essence needs to be this kindness. And it's something that the Dalai Lama emphasizes a lot. And I remember going to a couple of his talks over the years, many years ago now, one in Perth in St. George's Cathedral, which was years ago, and one here in one of the big stadiums. I think the tennis stadium, actually. I think.
Rod Laver.
Yes, that's right, Rod Laver Tennis Centre. And, you know, you can't help but be impressed by the Dalai Lama, just the quality of, you know, his peacefulness, his kindness, his, you know, all the things that he's talking about are really central human emotions, positive emotions, that regardless of religion, that's one of the things that I like very much, you know, whether you're a Christian or Buddhist, a Muslim, whatever, you know, you could respect this teaching and could get something from it. Because he's talking about essential human qualities. you know, when we develop the mind, we develop the heart. These are essential qualities. There's kindness, tolerance, patience, and peace is a big one that he emphasized. And of course, you know, when we say, you know, when he says that his religion is kindness, my religion is kindness, it's really emphasizing the fact that principle, the central principle of Buddhism, the whole of it, really focuses on non-harming, avihimsa we called it in Pali, non-harming ourselves, not harming others. So this is a very important aspect of the teachings, and of course it brings up, you know, this is what kindness is, really, not harming ourselves, not harming others. And of course, we have to start with ourselves, not harming ourselves. And if we realize when we have these negative emotions, we call them unwholesome mind states, negative emotions like anger, greed, jealousy, envy, and lots of desire, and ego too is in there as well. When we have these, we're actually being incredibly unkind to ourselves because we really suffer when we experience these states, these negative states. So if we develop a kindness, we can, as it were, address some of these negative states. If we develop the tendency to be kind, you know, this is something we can all do by just repeating, by focusing on being kind, developing more kindness in our speech and our actions, and by repeating it. Because this is how we develop our character, our personality. It's not set in concrete. It comes from our, you know, repetition of particular emotions, particular actions, particular speech. That becomes our habit. And then if we develop this kindness within ourselves, then we're always becoming, well, most of the time, becoming from a good place. And we can't go wrong in our practice if we're coming from kindness, because then the mind will be in a wholesome state, a positive state, and we will experience a lot more happiness in our life and a lot less conflict. So this is how we can condition our minds with this kindness. So what exactly is kindness? People will have their own take on kindness. Of course, in Buddhism, we talk about loving kindness, don't we? This is metta, and I like actually friendliness for that. But friendliness is part of kindness too. But I think I find too, kindness is just being thoughtful, isn't it? When we think of helping other people, we think of small things. This thoughtfulness, it can be very much appreciated. It's like going out of our way. So I think this is another aspect. And central to kindness is caring, isn't it? It really is. It's caring for ourselves, caring for others, really caring for ourselves. Sometimes, as I say, when these negative states of mind are running, we're not caring for ourselves. We're not looking after ourselves. And of course, you know, part of kindness too is having this patience that when we have to, we encounter situations that we have to just bear with. But patience is very important when we bear with something. We can bear with something by gritting our teeth, and there being a negative state of mind, you know, averse state of mind that says, oh, it shouldn't be like this. Or we can bear with things with a positive state of mind, with some kindness, loving kindness, knowing that that situation will change. This person who is saying or doing whatever they're saying and doing, they can change as well. And that they're coming, what they're doing and saying is coming from their conditioning, from what they believe at this moment. So, of course, that's important too. And kindness is one of the central qualities of kindness too, is respect. Respect for the differences. And this is what patience teaches us too, that we're all different. We're all different, but very similar, actually. Different, and we feel like we're unique, but we're actually very similar. But there are differences, and respecting those differences and not necessarily thinking they're wrong because, you know, they're coming from a different angle than us. So It's very, one of the things I notice, it's quite hard for us to be aware of when we are not coming from a good place, when we're not speaking and acting from a good place and thinking from a good place. And how can we, you know, how can we be aware? What are the signals that we can pick up that can give us a warning that things, what we're saying or doing, where we're coming from is not good? And I know the simile that occurred to me is at the fire, at the Newbury Buddhist Monastery where I'm living, we're preparing for the fire season, because now it's a fire season, and this is a terrible time in Australia. Last year, you remember how bad the bushfires were. And at the, during the fire season, you have to be prepared. So during the rain and all the wind and the fog or mist we get up there, I've been working on a fire plan with other monks and nuns. I think, my goodness, you know, that's what sort of summer is this? But I'm very thankful because we need to have a fire drill, actually, before the real thing happens. So it's actually quite good. And I think many Australians are quite happy that it's a little bit cooler this side of the country anyway. But part of that is that we have a checklist for the emergencies when there's a fire emergency. For instance, we may only have 30 minutes to leave. And so they recommend the country fire association recommends having a checklist so you can just go through it. Because when you're in these emergency situations, it's easy to panic and forget things that are very important. So I was thinking, you know, if we have an emotional checklist, and this is much easier to check up. You know, sometimes in Buddhism we can be very conceptual, we can have a lot of idealism, ideas and so on. But really, the emotions are the real indicator of what's going on for us, you know, whether we really are understanding the Buddha's teaching and whether we're really practicing the Buddha's teaching. And that's what I liked very much about the Dalai Lama, because those qualities he talked about, you could see in him, and you hear that, you know, from people who live with the Dalai Lama, that he is like that. And this is a very important indicator of really of spiritual progress, actually, is actually one's way of relating to other people, relating to ourselves. Is it kind? And so on my checklist, I was thinking, you know, for what I could check up on is, what am I, is what I'm doing, saying or thinking kind? Just to check that is a good way to decide whether we continue with an action or not. Is it tolerant and respectful? And that's quite useful. Is it leading to harmony? This is also very important in the world. And when we, as I mentioned during my talk on harmony here on the 27th of December, that it doesn't mean, harmony doesn't mean we all have to agree on whatever on a particular thing. We can agree to disagree, but respect the other person and their view. And also, is this what I am doing, saying or thinking peaceful? Is it encouraging peace in me and in the situation? And of course, one of the big ones is it wise? So there's a lot here, isn't it? It's a big checklist. Yes.
With the fire danger.
Fire danger, yes.
At the Newbury Buddhist Monastery.
Yes.
Does the monastery need any assistance?
We can, actually. We can, yeah, we always... Yes, that's always very helpful, actually. And afterwards, we can speak about it, because that is an important thing. Because 150 acres and there's lots of grass, and the forest is very near, and so it's an important thing that we're prepared for the fire season, because we're surrounded by forest. You know, to get in and out of the monastery is forest, so we have to be prepared. So thank you for that. And afterwards, if you would like to, you can speak to me or to Adrian, and you know, because we have volunteers coming to the monastery and they're helping with grass cutting and all that. And we have somebody who comes and cuts the grass and turns it into hay, so that helps. All those things, so it's good. And so If we look at this checklist of things, and we can see, is something wise? And one of the indicators for me if something is wise is whether I'm coming from ego, from self or not. Because when I see ego or self, I think, wow, you know, if I'm going to protect something, I'm arguing because I think this person's contradicting my view or whatever, you know. This is bound to be something that needs to be aware of and not necessarily acted upon. So those things can be a useful checklist, you know, if we are if we're finding that mind isn't kind or it isn't tolerant or isn't disrespectful, or it's not leading to harmony, it's not peaceful and it's not wise, then we can, if possible, put the brakes on. And this is called restraint in the Buddha's teaching. And it's such an important human quality to be able to restrain ourselves when we know something is not good, whether we're saying it or doing it or thinking it, to be able to say, no, I won't say that, I won't do that. And the thinking, to understand the thinking, that ability to restrain is incredibly important for us. For developing the path. So it's called Indriya Sanghara. And so it's very, very important, this restraint of the senses. And sometimes we can, you know, think we are practicing well, we're practicing the Noble Eightfold Path well in accordance with the Dhamma, but we may not be. And it's because of these defilements that come up and ego that come up when we are speaking, acting, or even thinking. And oftentimes we catch it later. Afterwards we think, oh no, I lost it again. That's all right, because at least we're aware that, you know, we lost it. And so we can next time we can be a little bit prepared, we can understand the conditions that gave rise to that. But it reminds me of one of the teachings that I liked very much from Ajahn Jagaro. Do people remember Ajahn Jagaro? Some, the older members will. He was the former abbot of Bodhnyana Monastery, Ajahn Brahm's monastery, and he was from Melbourne. And he used to come here and teach here quite a bit in the and disrobed in the 90s, 1995, as I remember. But he said many wise things. And one of his sayings, which I really liked, was that we can be right, but it can be not good. We can be right, but it can be not good. And he spoke about this quite often. I thought, actually, it was really coming from Ajahn Chah, and I think it probably did originally come from Ajahn Chah. But when I looked at Ajahn Chah's teachings, I don't find it quite like Ajahn Jagaro used to emphasize it. Do people remember that, who remember Ajahn Jagaro's teaching? Right but not good? Right but not good. All right. Because when we think things are right, if we think we're right, we can do, say, and think anything, actually. The limits are off, because we can become what we call, engage in, bring up righteous anger. And this is more of a Christian concept, you know, righteous anger, because the Buddha would say, there's nothing righteous about being angry. And of course, that is the case. It's a defilement, regardless of the fact of whether we're right or not, you know. And so this is something that when we have this righteous anger, you know, and I think many people probably have their own personal experience of it, we can do and say things that are harmful for ourselves and others as well. And I'm sure that many of the people who stormed the Capitol last week in the US, in Washington, and had this sort of riot or insurrection, they're calling it, and I'm sure they felt entirely right. Amazingly, they felt entirely right, and that they were entitled to be angry at what was happening, and thought they were doing a good thing, and maybe even thinking they were saving democracy. Of course, other people don't agree with that, but that, I'm sure they thought that. But when we have this feeling that we are right, or when we think we are right, I always say it's danger sign, danger, beware, beware, be careful, because then, as I say, we can do almost anything. And I wanted to tell an Ajahn Chah story today, because yesterday, do you remember what yesterday was? It was the 29th anniversary of Ajahn Chah's passing away in 1992. And I think most people know who Ajahn Chah was. He was an incredibly wise meditation teacher in Thailand. And so he's very well known for his wisdom. And it's sort of amazing wisdom that is so simple but goes to the heart. It's incredibly compelling. And his teaching has affected so many people worldwide. He has so many followers worldwide, whether they be monks, nuns, lay men or lay women. There's so many of them. And so it's amazing for somebody who is from a small village in the out of the back of beyond in Thailand. Bunwai? No, it's called what Papong is his monastery. So, and it's a one person can have such an effect for good in the world. But the story that I came across was from Ajahn Amaro remembers. It must be via Ajahn Sumedho. And it's from a talk called Not Holding Two Fixed Views. For those who recognize that phrase, it's a translation of from the Metta Sutta, the Buddha's words on loving kindness, which we just chanted in Pali. So, and this story concerns Ajahn Sumedho when he was a young monk at Ajahn Chah's monastery, Wat Pa Pong. He was only 2 or 3 years as a monk. And he was very diligent, very idealistic, and he took the monastic life, the training in the monastery very seriously. And he'd grown up, of course, in America, where we have the idea of some things are right and some things are wrong. You know, this a very, very strong idea of it. And there was a monk who was slightly more senior to him, a Thai monk, actually. And very unusually, this Thai monk, this not common, I would think, was very loud-mouthed, outspoken, and unrestrained about what he said. And it used to be a great... it used to annoy the other monks, and particularly Ajahn Sumedho. It's if you know Thailand or if you know Asia, Sri Lanka, you know that it's very unusual to have someone like this in a monastery, actually. And Ajahn Sumedho, he thought, this is totally out of order. Why isn't Ajahn Chah saying anything? This is ridiculous. Somebody ought to get up and... if somebody doesn't say something, I will. Sound familiar? I think it's very Western, very Western. And so the next opportunity, this was after months and probably almost a year or 2 years of this going on, he brought it up at a meeting of all the monks. You know, we get together and have a meeting for the reciting of the monks' rules. And he brought it up and he gave all the evidence and everybody agreed, you know, it was totally right what he said. It was true, yeah, he was like this and, you know, everybody suffered from it. But after that meeting Ajahn Chah wasn't there. He was out of the monastery. And so after that meeting, that monk that Ajahn Sumedho talked about was so shamed in public that he left the monastery and never came back. And then when Ajahn Chah returned to the monastery, a few days later he came back. And of course he heard what had happened, because these sort of confrontations, you know, it's very unusual in Asia to have big confrontations. It's not so unusual in the West. But in Asia it's very, you know, they avoid it like the plague. And so he spoke to Ajahn Sumedho then, and he said this, which is a really nice thing, actually. You know Tan Sumedho, that's like venerable in Thai. It's not an Ajahn yet, he wasn't then. What you said about the loud-mouth monk, you did, well, when you spoke about the loud-mouth monk, you did something very harmful there. You meant well, but what you did was harmful, because even though, and this is evidently a translation of the Thai, his mouth is bad, his heart is good. This is that monk. I knew that. Of course, everyone knows that. But how many monasteries do you think the fellow had to leave before he came here? This was the one place where he could stay and practice because I made space for him. But now you've closed the door on him and you have to take responsibility for that. He can't stay here anymore because you shamed him publicly. And so you have to acknowledge that that was poorly done on your part. You were right, in fact, but wrong in Dhamma. Isn't that an amazing story? You were right, in fact. This monk was very loud-mouthed. Probably most of the other monks would say, maybe the lay people too, obnoxious. He didn't know time and place. He would be saying things that he shouldn't say. And yes, Ajahn Sumedho was right, but as Ajahn Chah said, is you were wrong in Dhamma. And the consequences were that he had to leave. But what comes to mind for me, probably for you, of course, is the difference in culture. That's one thing that's very obvious. And also another thing is the kindness of Ajahn Chah, isn't it? That he allowed this monk, even though he knew he was, you know, a thorn in the side of the other monks and didn't have good speech, he still allowed him to stay in the monastery because he felt he had potential to develop the path. And you can see, of course, you know, this righteous anger, isn't it? You know, Ajahn Sumedho no doubt thinking, like we might think, you know, well, if I don't tell him, how can he change? And of course, you tell somebody like that, they can't change, you know. And this is often the way. The most powerful way to change a person is through kindness. If you're kind to them, then they can hear you. But this is not the way to change somebody. And it's a perfect example of, you know, righteous anger, you know. And it was exactly right. But it reminded me too of the Christian saying, you know, that the road to hell is paved with good intentions. So Ajahn Sumedho thought he was right and it was going to be good for this monk. It's always dangerous when we think something's good for somebody else. If it's good for us, that's okay. But good for somebody else. And that's where, you know, this... it's not a good intention. In actual fact, in Buddhism, we'd say that's a wrong intention, because righteous anger immediately makes it wrong, because where he's coming from is from a wrong place. And so that's very important for us to remember about this righteous anger. And I know it's even more important for people who are activists. Because sometimes, and I know for myself it's the case, I can get angry and upset, hot under the collar, on behalf of a group or a situation that I feel is unjust, you know, and there are many injustices in the world. But in reality, that anger, that indignation, that righteous indignation, it's right, this is, you know, this is an injustice, this is the case in many situations, but it's coming from the wrong place. And therefore, you know, the effectiveness of it will be reduced. I always remember the story from Quaker days, a Christian group, and a Quaker friend of mine said, because Quakers are very famous for peace activism. They do a lot of good throughout the world. They really do. They did prison reform and many, many, many things, very engaged socially. And Mary told me one day, she said there were two peace activists at the meeting house. They call it meeting house, the centre. And she said, they're the most unpeaceful people she'd met. Because she said, they're so angry. And they're so fired up. Because anger gives us energy, but it's not the sort of energy that's actually very useful for us. In the long run, we get burnt, and so do many other people. So this is something we can avoid through our wisdom, by understanding. And we realize that a lot of this, where this feeling of right comes from, of course, is in Buddhist terms. It's coming from our views, our dittis about situations, about ourselves, giving rise to perceptions, giving rise to thinking. So we see this with... You know, say for instance, those the storming of the Capitol. These people, their view was that they were defending democracy. Perception was that this was a threat to it. You know, these people were going to authorize the new president. And so their thinking and actions came from that. So all these things, you know, we are influenced by our upbringings, other people, the media, and the internet in particular, and hopefully by the Buddha. That's the good conditioning that we can take on. And also what I call kindness killer is fault finding, isn't it? We find that very much. It's the opposite of loving kindness is fault finding. And it's interesting because this is a source of disharmony and division in the world. And fault finding, you know, it comes from our educational system to a large extent. We are really encouraged to see how things could be better, how they could be improved, what's wrong in whatever we're doing, rather than looking at the whole bigger picture. And this problem can turn into problem solving, which is very useful and at the right time. And if it's used at the right time, it can be very useful. But when we develop this fault-finding, it's like we have myopia. Do you know what myopia is? Short-sightedness. It gives us tunnel vision. You know, I can do it myself. You know, I can look at a page of text and very quickly see mistakes because that's what my education has developed and encouraged. And we can all do that. But it means that we miss out on the bigger picture. And this is where the loving kindness, the kindness comes in, the bigger picture. And this is the antidote to it. So we can use this ability to problem solve, to see what's wrong, but not let it use us so that we start to see what's wrong with ourselves, with society, with everything. I mean, there are problems in society, but we can also look at the bigger picture as well. Look at the pluses in our relationships, in ourselves, in our society. And this, again, another quote from Ajahn Chah, because it was the Memorial Day yesterday. And he said, it's great, very down to earth. One of my teachers, this is a monk, ate very fast. He made noises as he ate. Yet he told us to eat slowly and mindfully. I used to watch him and get really upset. I suffered, but he didn't. I watched the outside. Later I learned. Some people drive very fast but carefully. Others drive slowly and have many accidents. If you watch others at most 10% of the time and watch yourself 90% of the time, your practice is okay. So that's a good advice for us. Isn't that interesting? And it's also being respectful of the fact that people are different, and we acknowledge that and we can accept that. Their conditioning is different, and this teacher that ate very fast and made noises. You know, that was maybe the way he was brought up. And also, maybe he was doing it as a lesson to his students. I don't know. It's hard to say, actually. That's interesting about people driving slow and driving fast. But yes, if we watch others 10% of the time and watch ourselves 90% of the time, then our practice is good. Then we'll have kindness too, because we'll be able to see what's going on in our mind. What is the actual situation? And as I say, when we are aware of the emotions, they're much easier to see than, say, lots of thoughts. You know, some people, for instance, they think of right view as being a good indicator of whether we're practicing well. But that's much more of a conceptual sort of thing. With the feelings, this is the second stage of the path, samasankappa, it's much more obvious. So, and I was going to mention the Buddha's checklist, because we have that checklist that I mentioned at the beginning. And I'll also mention, just briefly anyway, that Anjan Brahm has this, you've probably heard his idea of the peaceometer. Have you heard of this? The peaceometer in meditation, to see how peaceful the mind is, to gauge how peaceful the mind is. Because this is an indicator of if our meditation is settling down, is getting some depth. And so this is something we can use. We can visualize this peaceometer, you know, like the speedometer on the car. We can see whether we're getting more peaceful or less peaceful. Because one of the indicators that the path is developing, and we are, our understanding is developing, the meditation is developing, getting deeper, is that we're becoming more peaceful and less agitated. So it's something we can visualize, and it gives us an idea of the state of our emotions, where we're at. And I thought, well, maybe you could have a kindness-ometer or kind-ometer, you know, just checking how kind we are. The big problem in daily life is it's all happening so fast. That's where the problem is. We catch it later. And I thought of, too, the Buddha's checklist. I'm sure you all know this one from when his advice to his son, the Venerable Rahula, who must have told a deliberate lie. Evidently the lie he told was, in the commentaries they tell us, that he was only 7 years old. he's telling people that when they asked, is the Buddha here? He'd say, no, he's not here. He's not at the monastery. And he was. And sometimes he wasn't there, and he'd say, yes, he's here. So he was telling lies, not terrible lies, I thought. So the Buddha gave him a fantastic teaching on reflecting on how we're about to act, speak, or even think, and then during it, and then after it, to analyze what was going on. And his checklist is, does this lead to harm or benefit? Does it harm me? Does it harm others? Does it harm both of us? Or is there a benefit to me, to others and both of us? Sometimes that's difficult because, you know, if you think you're right, of course it, you know, you think you're benefiting the other person. Somebody had to tell them. If you didn't tell them, they may go on like that forever. You know, that idea of putting the world right. And is it coming from an unwholesome or wholesome intention or motivation? And so this is what I'm talking about, really, how to look at whether our motivation is wholesome or not. And I'll talk a little bit more about that. That's, to me, essential because, as I say, the emotions that come up, we can be pretty clear about them. The thoughts, well, there can be a spin of some one sort or another about what's happening. But the emotions are very direct. And did this action, speech or thought lead to painful or pleasant results, consequences? So that's the Buddha's way of analysing. And it's such a good checklist, actually, for morality, actually. It's really, really good. So I was going to talk more about this right intention or right motivation because that's really the key factor. This is where our emotions come up and probably should be, yes, that's not too bad. So right intention or right motivation is sammasankappa, the second factor of the Noble Eightfold Path. And of course it's coming from right view, samadhiti. But sometimes we can think our view is right, but we can certainly see that our emotional response, where we're coming from, is not right, which indicates, hang on, the view can't be right, actually. If I'm coming up with anger, if I'm coming up with irritation, a lot of desire, or if there is sort of harming, intending to harm others, intending to harm myself, or there's delusion, there's a lot of self running really, really strongly. So these are all indicators, yep, my view's not right. But they're much easier indicators to see of whether I'm coming from a good place or not.
Regarding the food that teaches
Rahula
to lie.
That lying, yes. That's in the Majjhima Nikaya, the middle length discourses, and it's usually, I think it's Sutta 61, and it's the advice to Rahula Ambalatika, Ambalatika Monastery. So it's in the middle length discourses. It's Bhikkhu Bodhi's done a translation in English, number 61 in that book. It's a brown colour, actually. They've got colour coded, so it's quite good. So this right motive at the end is good, yeah. So this right motivation is very important for how we practice the Noble Eightfold Path, because, you know, if we are getting, if we notice our motivation is wrong, if there's anger there, if there's a jealousy, envy, depression, whatever, it will affect all the rest of the Noble Eightfold Path. The way we practice the Eightfold Path will be affected, because if our intention is wrong, if this motivation where we're coming from is wrong, what we say will be of a similar nature. Actually, it has to be consistent with with the anger, the irritation, whatever we're coming up with, or strong desires coming up with. And not only will our actions be of that nature, our speech will be of that nature, and it will affect. It affects too the way we meditate. So you can actually find there are people who are very forceful with the meditation, very forceful with the mindfulness, very forceful and looking to get from the meditation. And this is actually, you can see, this is not coming from right intention, right motivation, which I'll talk about in a little bit more detail, because the right motivation is not coming from getting and gaining. It's not coming from ill will. It's not coming from harming. These are the basic. It's coming from giving up, letting go, as Ajahn Brahm's now calling it, letting go, and from non-ill will. These are things like loving kindness, but not only loving kindness, and non-harming, like compassion. So I'll talk about that in a minute. So when we have when we're coming from the wrong place, the rest of our practice follows. That it will be of a wrong, coming from the wrong place. So, and I know you've probably all heard Ajahn Brahm's phrase, make peace, be kind, be gentle. And this is meant to be the right intention or right motivation. Now he's changed the first one to letting go and be kind and be gentle. Because letting go is much more consistent with renunciation, giving up, not looking through our happiness through the... What are we renouncing? It's always, renunciation always sounds... It's interesting, but for most people, in the West, most people find it difficult to know what this renunciation is about. It's about looking for our happiness inside, looking for spiritual happiness rather than looking for happiness where we always have looked for it. Through our senses, through hearing, seeing, smelling, tasting and touching. And so that's what renunciation is about. And when the Buddha left the palace, for instance, they call that the great renunciation, because he was living in the lap of luxury. He had everything, all the best foods. He had a harem, he had musicians, he had everything, And so many people would say, why leave? But he also realized that this is not where happiness lies, out there. And we all know, even people who are not practicing spiritual path know in their hearts that happiness is inside. This is where it's coming from. So that's a very important part when we, in our motivation, are we trying to get something? Are we trying to, whether it be from our senses, from the meditation, if we're trying to get and gain from a meditation, this is not a good motivation. And it'll lead to quite a bit of dukkha, because often we get frustrated. We don't get what we want. And of course, renunciation is an aspect of it is giving to others and instead thinking about others. So this is important. And the second aspect, of course, of right intention, right motivation is non-ill will, avyapada. And of course that's this kindness that I'm talking about today, loving kindness. It's many positive emotions in the Buddha's teaching, like joy with other successes or good qualities, that's mudita. And this is a very great antidote to jealousy and envy. And equanimity, upeka we call it. And this is the emotion, I call it emotion actually, of acceptance of things as they are at this moment. They won't be, they can change, and they will change, whether you like it or not. But acceptance, so it's another emotion. Patience, this patience is this kind ability to bear with things that aren't necessarily easy. Thankfulness is another wonderful emotion when we realize there's so much in our lives that is a plus. And as I said, the fault-finding mind won't necessarily see that. It will say, well, this is not right, that's not right. But when we look at the pluses in our lives, there's many more than the fault-finding mind will admit. And contentment and respect and faith, these are all aspects of non-ill will. And the third aspect of it is non-harming, avihinksa. And as I mentioned, kindness, really the central principle support for kindness is that we're not going to harm ourselves or others. We're going to be kind to ourselves and others. And of course, the principal quality that the Buddha emphasized for this is compassion, karuna. You know, this is really this compassion for ourselves, the difficulties we experience, and the compassion for the difficulties other beings experience. The important thing with compassion is that we feel with the person, we have empathy with them, but that we don't necessarily suffer with them. As Aikima used to say, if we suffer with somebody who's already suffering, there are two people suffering now instead of one. She was very practical. And also we can't help them very much if we're suffering along with them. It pretty much disables us. And also the other aspect, which is what Ajahn Brahm has emphasized when he has the saying, let go, be kind, be gentle, is gentleness and softness in our speech and in our actions as well. And in our thoughts particularly, towards ourselves and towards others. And again, you know, you have patience as well, respect is important, and equanimity. So we can check up where we're coming from. And if we're coming from these three aspects of renunciation, letting go, if we're coming from being kind, loving kindness, if we're coming from gentleness, having compassion, no problem. We're safe. So if we're coming from those, then we're okay. If we're not coming from those, then I think we need this restraint to just say, hang on for a while, and then not necessarily act on it. And important, we have some practical things that we can do in order to develop kindness in our life. And I think you'll probably remember, I remember it. I was a bit shocked that it was so long ago. In the 1980s, we had this idea of doing random acts of kindness and senseless beauty. I think it was something like that. There's lots of different permutations of it. But it's still quite valid, really. I was looking for the sort of the quote on these random acts of kindness, and I saw one from Princess Diana. Unbelievable. I didn't know she'd said this, but it says she did. So it was obviously the fashion at the time. And she said, carry out a random act of kindness with no expectation of reward, safe in the knowledge that one day someone might do the same for you. Quite nice, isn't it? That's a nice thing to say, actually. So this is kindness in action. The random acts of kindness, I think one can be actually a little bit more structured with it in one's randomness, because I think the people that we need to show the most random kindness to are the people we live with, the ones we're closest to. You know, if we do it to complete strangers, that's lovely. That's very nice. But to do it to those that we are very close to is much more beneficial. I feel it's a plus. So, So this is something we can do, you know, through giving or sharing is probably the one of the main modes of doing something every day that is kind through what we do, what we say, and what we think. And as you might remember from the talk that I gave on harmony, the Buddha emphasizes loving kindness in public and in private, through body, through our actions, through our speech, and through our mind. And so they, if we can develop this kindness in those three areas, towards our family, our friends, our work colleagues, the people that we go to school with, that is a wonderful act of kindness. And it can be material things or immaterial things. It doesn't have to be material things, you know. And I remember somebody told me, I asked them, you know, they were going from the monastery for Christmas with the family, and I said, oh, do you give presents? He said, oh, no, we stopped that years ago. And in a way I thought, oh, what a shame. Because these little things make a difference, actually. And I said, you can always give food, can't you? Something you can eat, you know, because that won't hang around. You don't have to take it back and change it or whatever. But there's also immaterial things like a smile and words of encouragement. A kind word can go a long, long way, particularly at the right time. And even, because I get it, I'm sure you get it too, people sharing things on the internet. And some of them are very nice. Some of them very nice. Some things you think, wow, I don't know about that. So these are ways that we can develop this kindness. And as I say, particularly important with those that we live with. So we don't take them for granted. And giving gifts is one of the ways the Buddha recommends for creating a sense of bonding between people. And also keeping the precepts. This is kindness to other people. Because they know that we won't harm them, you know, we won't lie to them, we won't steal from them, we will not commit sexual misconduct, and we're not taking drugs and alcohol, which may make everything else possible. So this is a real gift too, and it's something, it's a kindness. You can see the value of it. It's kind to others and to ourselves. And of course, kindness is what we're developing through the meditation. This is really where we can do the reconditioning of the mind, especially if we develop loving kindness, if we develop compassion, joy with others, successes or good qualities, and also with equanimity, with acceptance. But of course, one of the most important places we can develop kindness is in mindfulness. Because mindfulness, when we're in the present moment, it's not conditioned so much by the past, what other people said or did, which can bring up anger, irritation, sense of injustice, outrage or whatever. And we're not off into the future, we're in the present moment. And the present moment actually is a place that's quite, in a sense, neutral. We don't tend to have so much of the negative baggage from the past, or the projection of fear and anxiety to the future. And Ajahn Ram, of course, he calls this kindfulness. So it's quite nice, isn't it, kindfulness? And it is, really. We're just looking at what the present moment is without a lot of the conditioning from the past. And, of course, I mentioned the other meditations that we can develop. But, of course, one of the big things is to develop our wisdom. That develops kindfulness too. Because the big support for loving kindness is understanding that all beings are of a similar nature. They want this friendliness, they want this happiness in their lives. Understanding that this understanding can help us actually in developing more loving kindness. I know Ayakema used to do, interestingly, a loving kindness meditation, guided meditation, but she also did a contemplation about the qualities that support the understanding of loving kindness, because there's a lot of understanding behind it. And if our understanding is kind, it will be kind. If it's real understanding, if we really see the nature that people, ourselves included, we are conditioned phenomena. you know, this body and this mind is as it is because of the past, the things that have influenced us, the things that have created the habits that we take to be ourselves, our personalities and so on. And when we understand that and that others are the same nature, we can have a lot of compassion, acceptance for them too, because we realize they can't be any different at this moment. They can't be any different than they are, but they're not set in concrete. They can change. So I'd like to finish off now. I'm going a bit late. So to develop this kindness and to perhaps develop the kindness omita or kind-omita in our actions, in our speech, and in our thoughts particularly. And it's also for our spiritual development, it will lead to a lot of happiness for us, but it will lead to our development of the path, our spiritual development. It's not in our, and I think it's very true of the world, it's not so much what we achieve, but how we achieve it that's the important issue. You know, and this is always something when we're running a spiritual organization. Worldly organizations don't work on that principle. They don't think it's not so important what we achieve. Of course, for them, that's the most important thing. They're not so much concerned often how they achieve it. But in a spiritual organization like the Buddhist Society of Victoria, we should be more concerned with how we achieve something rather than if we do get what we were aiming at. It's good if we do, but if we've actually achieved something in a good way, that's far, far more important. And we have this saying about the journey being more important than the destination. I could say the journey is the destination. Developing these good qualities of mind, this kindness, developing wisdom is the goal, is the path. And so we can remember to let go, be kind, be gentle. That's a nice way to remember these good qualities that we can develop. And when we're reminded of things, it really means that it can come up for us. And I'd like to end with another quote from the Dalai Lama. And it is, be kind whenever possible. And he says, it's always possible. Isn't that great? I like that. Very, very good. It's lovely. It goes right to the heart. So simple, but it goes to the heart. And that's, I think, the important thing. We can tell where the heart is. You know, the mind, well, there may be all different spins and stories that we tell about whatever we're doing, what others are doing, but we can tell from the heart where we're coming from. And that's the most important aspect of the spiritual path and the spiritual journey. So thank you for listening today. And I've gone on a little long, but now if there are any questions, complaints, or comments, you're welcome to make them now. That's what you say, you've been too kind.
If anyone does have a question, could they please come up and use the microphone so everyone can hear?
All right.
Thank you, Ajahn.
Yes.
I just had a question going back to the story with Ajahn Chah and that monk who... He raised his concerns about that other monk.
Yes.
Could he have not done it in a more wholesome, kind way, but still, I don't know, let his, like, raise concerns?
Yeah.
I was just wondering.
Yes, that's an interesting. Could that monk, Ajahn Sumedho, have raised that his concerns about that loud-mouthed monk in a different way that would have been more constructive. Yeah, I think given the culture, I would say not directly. I think it would have to be some indirect method. I'm not sure how that would be. The most obvious one is for Ajahn Chah to speak to that monk. And even, you know, you hear, I know Ajahn Brahm says it all the time in the monastery, if you've got a big problem with somebody, tell me. I'll deal with them, don't tell them off. And then he doesn't. So this is quite interesting. But it throws it back to the person. Because really, in the whole of the spiritual path is looking at where we're coming from. And so for what Ajahn Chah was really doing for Ajahn Sen later was telling him, look where you're coming from, you know. And yes, you were right, but what you said was not good. It wasn't good in the Dhamma. And that's the most important thing for us. You know, it had the negative. It wasn't good where he was coming from because of righteous anger. And the result wasn't good either because that monk left. And according to Ajahn Chah, where could he go? Most other monasteries throw him out too. Quite interesting, isn't it? No, he left because he felt ashamed. He was really upset. No, he didn't want to leave, but because, you know, Ajahn Sumedho had said how terrible his verbal conduct was, how the way he was speaking in the monastery and what he was saying and all that sort of thing, he was so embarrassed that he left. In the West, it would be more... it would be a problem, but it wouldn't be so embarrassing that, say, a monk would have to leave. We'd say, in the West, we'd probably say, oh, it's just your opinion. But all the rest of the monks certainly agreed with him. So I think, thank you for that question. And I think in that, as I said, I think the only way he could have done it is some indirect way. Often the way a teacher does it is if they can mirror what the person's doing, and then the other person can see it, and then they may get the message. But they have to do it with a lot of loving kindness, because any sort of fault finding, negativity, it sets up an immediate resistance from the person you're trying to help. So thank you for that. That's a good reflection. Yeah, you wonder. Yes. Oh, hello, Dr. Chaya. Hello.
On the same topic, there are a couple of things to learn from that particular episode, what I say.
Yeah, good.
The Buddha always said in many discourses that don't judge because you are not in a position to judge. So these monks may have judged that this person is not practicing, he is not up to the mark. So that's a judgment that they would have been wrong.
Yes.
Ajahn Chah knew it, but the monks didn't know it.
Mm. Yes,
other true. Thing is that they acted because it was hindrance for them, because he was upsetting the other monks. So it's a selfish behavior. But probably if they were a bit wiser, they could have used that to practice patience and understand the person rather than acting like that.
Yes. That's very true. And that was one of the big teachings of Ajahn Chah, wasn't it? Patient endurance, you know, to be able to be patient with situations and people that are not necessarily the way we would like them, you know, if we find unpleasant. So that's good. Yeah, thank you for that. That's good. So, yes, and I think that was probably part of the lesson that Ajahn Sumedho got, is that to be patient with people. Be patient with himself, be patient with people, and also to realize that a different culture, you know, you address things differently. In the West, we're much, much more confrontational, and that can have its benefits and it's also its drawbacks as well. So it's a matter of culture as well. So time and place is very much a teaching too that he would have got from that, you know, that this wasn't the right place to do that. So is there any more questions before we go? Oh, there's one there. Ah, there we are. I can't see who it is. Hello.
Hi, John. It's Stephen.
Oh, hi, Steve. Yeah.
I just had two questions, actually. First one is that my life has become a lot more busier lately since I recently just started studying again.
Mm-hmm.
And I've noticed that with a lot of the extra stress, it's becoming a lot harder to guard against things like getting angry or agitated with people. And, you know, when I'm particularly tired and I'm not getting as much sleep as I was, it's harder to not be tempted into breaking the precepts, like gossiping or maybe drinking a bit too much.
Yeah.
That's my first question. The second question is a bit more of a general one. With the precept in regards to alcohol in particular, I know that when I took the precepts with you, it was like to abstain from consuming alcohol to the point where you become heedless. But just from reading like Bhikkhu Bodhi's translations of the Buddhist teachings, he seemed a bit like the Buddha seemed a bit more explicit about no, you shouldn't drink alcohol at all. So I'm just wondering of your opinion on that as well.
Thank you for that, Steve. Yes, because stress and when we're tired does make it difficult for us to. We're more reactive, actually. You notice that we're more reactive. And the Buddha often mentioned that when we experience a dukkha, stress is dukkha. Dukkha is suffering or unsatisfactoriness. When we experience that, then the tendency for us is to look for happiness. And it's the happiness of the five senses. So, you know, I think in COVID times, people have put on a lot of weight. Some people have put on a lot of weight. Some people have been drinking a lot more and so on. Because this is a reaction to what the Buddha would call unpleasant feeling, dukkha vedana, coming from the mind, actually. It's really coming from the mind. And because of that, looking for some happiness out in the world. So it is quite natural if we're stressed or tired that we will, you know, react. Will be very much more reactive to things. But to keep that in mind, and of course kindness to ourselves in that situation is trying to get more sleep, kindness in terms of the stress level that we may feel, just to feel kind to yourself, have this sort of looking after yourself, like almost like a child in a way, is very, very useful. You know, even you know, like you can think, well, even if I don't get the assignment done, the exam doesn't go well, so what? You know, I'll be kind to myself. Instead, you know, we're often being unkind to ourselves by letting the fears, the anxiety, they really can run riot. And yes, it could happen, you know. What if? We say, what if? What if, you know, I fail the exam? What if I don't get the assignment in, you know? And, you know, I lose my place in the university, the college, whatever it is. So what if can really play havoc with us. But the kindness will say to us, what if it doesn't happen? You know, be kind to myself, you know. And in actual fact, we tend to perform much better when we feel we're kind to ourselves. It gives a sense of security, of stability, that will be better for our abilities to deal with things. And it's a much more pleasant experience. But it's a part of life. Stress is definitely. And so it's, you know, dukkha, one of the translations of dukkha is stress. So it's what we do with that stress that's the important thing, you know. And so the Buddha's suggestion is seeing that the cause of it is wanting it to be other than it is at this particular moment, and letting go of that wanting, and that's a kind thing to do, then there will be more stability, the reduction in the stress and the unpleasant experience we're having. So this is, it's really good in a sense, you know, that we relate our experience to the Buddha's teaching, the Four Noble Truths. We're getting it, getting it in one. Ajahn Sumedho was very big on Four Noble Truths, and it's teaching us all the time, actually, if we're just aware of it. So I hope that answers that one. And the second one about alcohol, yes, it is a complete abstinence is the best thing with alcohol because it's very difficult, you know, to draw limits. You know, people think, oh, just have a little, and then a little gets more and more. And I always remember Ajahn Jagro said, well, it would be okay to drink if it was a necessity of life. If alcohol was something the body required, you know, to function, or drugs required to function, then perhaps it would be okay. But it's not. It's not a necessity for life, you know. And the important thing with alcohol and drugs is we see the effect, the negative effects it can have, you know, because they're pretty obvious in the news you see. It's a big problem for people. And when people take alcohol and drugs, not everybody's doing this. You know, it's in the news. Only some people in some situations. You know, anything else can happen. You know, they can kill each other, they can steal, they can have sexual misconduct, very common in that context of drinking or taking drugs. And also lying can happen. So we can break all of them quite easily with drinking. So, no, it's a much easier, the zero tolerance approach is much easier, I think, for people, you know. It's just in a society that doesn't is so conditioned to accept alcohol and drugs that it's difficult, because people then think you're a wowser or something like that, and you have to be very skillful about that, because there's quite a bit of pressure to drink and so on in certain situations. So I hope that. Thank you, Steve. Yeah, very good. And are there any questions, Langdon? Yes.
We do have some online questions,
Ajahn. Yes, yes.
So, but we're running short of time, so I think we either have time for one detailed answer or four brief answers.
Or four brief answers, yes, all right.
So I'll leave it up to you, Ajahn.
Cryptic answers. I have to say kindness, yes. Four times.
That probably is the answer to everything. The first question is from someone who's asked similar questions before, but they're obviously struggling with it. Nobody around me is a Buddhist. How do I keep not discouraged? How do I stay motivated when my kindness does not seem to be acknowledged, it's not working, or people use me for it? It's used for convenience.
Right. Yes, I hear that actually quite often, because people, I can still remember in Sri Lanka somebody saying, you know, but if I have a lot of loving kindness for everybody, they'll use me as a doormat. You know, and I think people have to see the value in this situation. I can see the person's expecting something back, and loving kindness and kindness, if you expect something back, we're setting ourselves up for disappointment, absolutely, you know. So I would say kindness or loving kindness is its own reward. We have that feeling of happiness, having done a good thing, having been kind. Doing a kind act, saying something kind, comes from a kind mind. So we're experiencing the benefit then and there. But if we feel like, well, what's the point? Because they didn't say thank you, they didn't appreciate it one bit, or they're taking advantage of me. The mind that thinks that is obviously negative. It's gone negative already. So we have to look what's going on in our own minds. And if other people miss the opportunity to be thankful, to be grateful, to acknowledge what one's done, that's their loss, really. That's how I feel. They've missed out on some happiness from being thankful someone's thought of us, done something nice, said something nice. So I think...
Thank you. I think you've just answered the second question as well, which was how to overcome my practice of metta to some friends who take advantage.
Right. So yeah, that's
very similar. The next question is a bit of a general one. Namaste. How to practice loving kindness and protect myself from harmful beings? How could the Dalai Lama do that, I wonder?
Mm. Well, loving kindness is a protection against harmful beings, really. If you really have loving kindness in your mind, then that will deal with harmful beings. And in fact, the origin story for the Buddha teaching loving kindness was some monks who were living in a forest, and they were being disturbed by non-human sort of spirits that lived in the forest, who were upset that these monks were invading their space, you know, and so they wanted to get rid of them. So they tried to scare them, make spooky sounds and do all sorts of things that would drive them out of the forest. And, of course, they did. They went and saw the Buddha, and the Buddha said, what you need to do is use loving kindness. So they, and because obviously, you know, when people are doing these sorts of things, they think, get out of here, we don't want, you know, you think you react in a similar way. That's the problem, actually. We react in a similar way to these beings who wanted to get rid of the monks. And so the monks were probably angry with these beings or whatever, upset with them. And then when they saw the Buddha said, no, loving kindness. So they came back to that forest, according to this story, developed loving kindness, and then the beings were very happy that these monks were living there in the forest. So the way we, the states of mind we develop, the motivations we develop, do actually affect other people. And that's why, you know, changing another person's not so easy. But if we change ourselves, it may change the relationship too. Because often the equation, the balance changes if we change. We can't make the other person change. But if we change, it can bring change for them. And I often tell the story of a person in Sri Lanka. She said she hadn't been speaking to her sisters for years. But then she changed. She started listening to Ajahn Brahm and developing more wisdom and loving kindness and so on within herself. And then it changed with her sisters. She was able to start speaking to them again, almost without her organizing. It was quite interesting. The dynamic had changed. Something had changed. So that's an important aspect of it. If we have loving kindness, that gives us protection, actually. It is a protection for the mind. And it can affect other beings as well. So hopefully that answered that one.
Okay, thank you. There are two more questions, but I'm going to suggest the person who asked about jhanas.
Oh, yeah.
Do ask that after the meditation session, tomorrow night instead, just to get through. Because the last question relates to loving kindness, which is on the theme of today.
Yeah.
When I am dying, can I practice loving kindness and how can that help my rebirth?
Right, yes. When I'm dying, can I practice loving kindness and how can that help my rebirth? Yes, you can. I think that's possible. And the way you can develop loving kindness or practice loving kindness when you're dying is practice it a lot while you're living, you know, before you get to dying. So it's a habit. You know, it's a bit late if you just start just before you're about to pass from this world. The mind's about to split from the body. As the Buddha would say, the body's going to break up. No, it's if you develop that habit of loving kindness, that's what will come out, you know, at that time of death, that kindness to those that are around us, because you know they probably find it difficult. The body is going to pass away, that the relationship that they experience with you is going to change. And so this can be, it's sort of kindness, but also compassion. Because, you know, these Brahma Viharas, the four divine abidings of loving kindness, compassion, joy, and also equanimity or acceptance, they all come together to a certain extent. They all have this aspect of loving kindness. But in that case, you know, you can have compassion for the family, the friends who may, you know, be grieving at that time. And certainly if you have loving kindness in the mind, there'll be less fear about death. And also for those that are nearby, they probably feel a lot happier or feel more at peace with your passing away if you go in a very gentle, very peaceful way. And I know, you know, for instance, when my mother passed away, she'd been in hospital 6 days, and, you know, I was there with my second eldest brother and his wife, and, you know, she was sort of I thought she was sort of unconscious, really, but one of my brothers came earlier, just before she had died, and the phone went off and their eyes opened. I thought, oh, good, someone's still at home. But she just, the breathing just got more and more, slower and slower and slower, and then just stopped. But it was so peaceful that none of us, the three of us, myself, my older brother and his wife, we didn't feel upset. We thought, fantastic, what a good way to leave. You know, I thought, this is a good send-off. Not only that, only an hour or so later, or maybe less, some monks came and we did some chanting for her. I thought, oh, Mum, you've got a lot of merit, a lot of good karma for this to happen. So that makes it much easier for people if you've got a very, because loving kindness is peaceful, is kind. And therefore, it'll make it easier for others around us too. They they will be able to accept it much better. So thank you very much, and now we can finish off, because now nearly 20 to 11, time for the shared meal. Everybody's welcome. And for those who would like to, you can, we can join in and pay respects to the Buddha, Dhamma and Sangha, where this all came from. But kindness comes from within.